And you are listening to KPCW and This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our impacts upon it. I'm Claire Wiley. And on today's show, we are going to be hearkening back to a couple of our favorite topics from 2024, penguins and wolves. That's right. First on the show, we're going to be talking with biologist Naira DeGracia. We're going to be discussing her book about the last cold place, a field season studying penguins in Antarctica. In it, DeGracia offers a dramatic and captivating window into a generation of chinstrap penguins in Antarctica. And then biologist and professor of wildlife ecology at Michigan Tech, John Vucetich, discusses the study of wolves and moose of the boreal forest on Isle Royale National Park. He is also the author, that is, of Restoring the Balance, What Wolves Tell Us About Our Relationship with Nature. That's all coming up on This Green Earth.
And joining us is Naira DeGracia. She's a biologist and the author of the new book, The Last Cold Place, a field season studying penguins in Antarctica. Naira, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's talk about you first. Give us a little background on yourself. Why did you decide to become a biologist and what led you to Antarctica?
Yeah, so I guess I can start by mentioning that I grew up moving around a lot. My parents are journalists and we moved to a new country every few years. So I had a little bit of an uprooted childhood, but I always found myself to be most grounded when I was like hanging out in a forest or up in mountains or in trees. And when I went to university, I was really drawn to biology and the understanding of ecosystems as like this bigger bio system that was beyond like human constructs. And I worked at as a field season in Maine as a technician on a seabird nesting island. And I just really was compelled by the lifestyle of field work first, I think. And then my love for like the discipline followed. And I really enjoyed living in these remote places and being able to see ecosystems that few people get to see. And I think I've always been driven towards the more intense or the most intense version of any experience. So in that sense, I really wanted to work in Antarctica because of the isolation of the experience and also how amazing the ecosystem down there is and how immersive the field camp down there was. So yeah, I did a few field jobs after university and eventually I got the Antarctica job, which was my goal. So I headed down there.
What is a field season?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm so used to using these terms, eh?
Yeah.
So basically, any study that has a long-term monitoring aspect that looks at an ecosystem over many years, when you see studies that show declines in population or declines in reproductive capacity, that's usually because they have these monitoring camps in place that follow seabird or seal populations over many, many years with the same methodology. So these studies tend to have technicians like me that go out there for the season, which is basically the breeding season of that species or target plural species that the study is looking at. And we basically are out there counting populations and then we track nests or seal pairs to see how many of the young that are produced actually make it to young adulthood and see how successful the species is that season. So a field season is basically that reproductive period in which technicians are stationed in the field or in the study area to monitor a population.
And so the species that you're focused on were chinstrap penguins. So give us a little thumbnail sketch of what a chinstrap penguin is.
Yeah, so we were looking at two species actually, were chinstraps and gentoos. So they're both, they live in the Southern Ocean, which is basically the circumpolar ocean around Antarctica. They feed, chinstraps mostly feed on krill during the winter and in the summer breeding season as well. And gentoos feed more on fish than krill, but also eat a lot of krill. And basically these penguins are out in the ocean all winter and they only come to land. They come to land in the summer to breed and they usually breed on these small islands like off the coast of Antarctica. So that's when we coincide with them and we can study their behavior. But they're being impacted by climate change in a pretty severe way because krill depends on ice in the early stages of their development. And as temperatures warm, the ice around Antarctica, the sea ice cover is decreasing year after year. And mm-hmm. so that means there's less habitat for young krill and there's less krill out in the ocean. So the food source is declining. So we are seeing declines in chinstrap and gentoo penguins. And that was a big focus of the monitoring program that I worked on.
So in these comparisons of where life has been in the past, there, where it is now, and what the projections are for the future, what are you seeing now that is in decline from how it had maybe been thriving in the past?
Yeah, so it's interesting to see how different species respond to these environmental changes. Like, for example, I mentioned that chinstraps are more dependent on krill, so they are showing a bigger decline in population, but gentoos have a bit more of a flexible diet. Mm. So they can also eat fish or like other small, you know, swimming creatures in the ocean, and they're able to adapt a little easier. And chinstraps as well have a bit of more of an abrupt leap into adulthood. They literally just stop getting fed by the adults and just have to swim into the ocean and learn to feed and survive. Whereas gentoos have a bit of a buffer period where the young kind of swim around a bit and learn to hunt while also still being fed by the adults. So these changes in these differences in their life history is really affecting how they're responding to climate change. And then on the other side, in the marine mammal side, we're seeing like really big declines in fur seals, Antarctic fur seals, which was the other species that was studied in the camp that I worked at. So they are also krill dependent. And that has more to do with habitat shifting for leopard seals. So leopard seals used to hang out on ice, but because there's a lot less ice, they've started hanging out more on the shore of these islands where Antarctic seals breed, Antarctic fur seals breed. And so they end up eating a lot more Antarctic fur seal pups because they're forced to live more on land. And so that's also driving the decline in Antarctic fur seals. So it's all these like very specific dynamics that each species has that, yeah, impacts how sensitive they are to changes in the environment.
Wow. Okay. Again, the ripple effects associated with a warming world, in this case, warming seas and such. But I want to go back. I want to go back to the chinstraps and try to understand. You say the adults, I'm going to say, are out at sea all winter. A, mm-hmm. how long is this winter? And B, what does it mean literally to be out at sea for months and months at a time?
Yeah, they sound like medieval sailors when I put it that way.
Yeah.
Out at sea. So they're pelagic seabirds. So basically what that means, like a lot of other seabirds, is that they don't need land to live. Mm. They use land to reproduce and to have nests. But like in the first 2 or 3 years of their life, for example, before they're of breeding age, they just live in the ocean. So they're able to feed in the ocean. They sleep on the surface of the ocean. They rest on the surface of the ocean. They just sit on the surface, kind of like a duck, like you would imagine mm-hmm. how a duck would sit. And that's just their habitat. That's the habitat they evolved on. And it becomes like pretty obvious when you do encounter them on land, because they're pretty clumsy and awkward on land. You know, they're always like wobbling around and falling down, and like they have these short little stubby legs. But yeah, in the sea, that's their primary habitat. They're just like amazing, amazing swimmers and super strong. They just take off like little torpedoes. So yeah, that's sort of what I mean when their primary habitat is in the ocean. But it's really difficult to study penguins or seabirds in general when they're not in the breeding season, when they're out in the ocean, just because they're so spread out and inaccessible to us. So
right.
that breeding season window is like 3 months where we can really access that species. Yeah,
that was what I was going to ask. What does a day look like? How do you research them? How do you get into their habitat, and how do they respond to you?
Yeah, so the colony that we were studying was about an hour walk from main camp. So we had a little hut out at the penguin colonies, and we'd hike out there in the morning, and we'd basically do what we call rounds, which is we check our colonies. So a colony is just like a grouping of nests, basically, on little hills where the snow melts earlier. So they're able to build their nests there out of little pebbles. And we check certain nests that we're following to see if there are any updates to, like, have the chicks hatched or have the chicks fledged, depending on what time in the season it is. And then also depending on what time in the season is, we have other things that we do in the colonies, like we'll do banding early season, or sometimes we'll attach devices that that track their dives when they go out to forage, or we look for penguins in the area that are banded from previous years. So we do a lot of resighting. Then we do like certain waves of population counts and weighing chicks. So just a whole bunch of different metrics that indicate different things about how the population is doing. And then, yeah, we basically spend all day out there in the colonies. And the penguins they're not like overly scared of us because they didn't really evolve with terrestrial predators. Like there aren't any terrestrial predators in Antarctica. So they just kind of treat you like a really big penguin, which is great. Mm. And it makes it, I mean, we catch them by basically just walking up to their nests and picking them up. So it makes that part of it easier.
So this is just a few months of non-winter conditions, I guess. And this is when the chicks are raised during this period of time. I'm just trying to figure out, are the chicks ever left alone while the adults are out at sea?
Yeah, that's a great question. So they're basically two parents per nest. And once the female lays the two eggs, she goes off to sea to replenish her energy, and the male will sit on the eggs. And then after that, they take turns incubating. And once the chicks hatch, there'll always be an adult at the nest while the other adult is out foraging until the chicks creche, what we call creche, which is basically when they're old enough to be safe from skuas, who are these like predatory seabirds that kind of are in the area, can pick off little chicks that are abandoned by their parents. And also big enough to be able to thermoregulate on their own to be warm. So they're about like 2 or 3 kilos at that point. And then they are left alone by their parents. And they just huddle together in this like giant fluffy pile in the colonies. And then their parents will still come back to feed them regularly, but they'll be out at sea more. And they'll just recognize their chick, and their chick will come up to them, and they'll feed them that way. Yeah, so there are different like life stages to the chick rearing process.
I'm always amazed, you know, at their ability to adults to go out on business for months at a time and then come home and find their home and find their chick, because these are colonies, which, you know, the classic image of penguin colonies, they are stuffed. It's a very dense setting. Is that the same? Is that what chinstrap penguins colonies look like?
Yeah, definitely. It's pretty high density, and it is really funny. I mean, I think it's hard not to project like what we imagine they would feel onto the penguins. But I like when they are down at the shore about to head into the ocean, they just look so dirty. They're full of poop. They're just like exhausted, like hungry. And they spend their whole life in the ocean where there's so much space, and just, you know, they're not crowded together most of the time. So I think it is like a really different experience for a penguin to be jam-packed in those colonies. And then when they come back, they're always like dawdling and procrastinating, going back to their nest. That's what it seems like. I don't know. Probably anthropomorphizing, but.
I think probably parents out there can relate.
Exactly. They're like, it's my turn again, damn it.
Yeah. Lanieri introduced her as being with Naira de Grazia, the biologist and the author of the book, The Last Cold Place, A Field Season Studying Penguins in Antarctica. So you mentioned briefly some of the changes or challenges that penguins and the entire ecosystem is undergoing in Antarctica with respect to climate change. First, let's talk about what is changing. We know that the oceans are getting warmer. This is probably not your field of expertise, but is it also impacting the seasons themselves? Are the winters getting warmer? Are storms expressing themselves differently? Can you give us a little overview on what climate change looks like in three dimensions?
Yeah. So obviously Antarctica is a huge continent, and this slight increase in temperature is manifesting differently across the continent. But what we're the trends that we're seeing most clearly is that it's becoming warmer. The difference is bigger in the winter than it is in the summer. Mm-hmm. And what that means essentially, as I mentioned earlier, is there's a reduction in the sea ice crust. So every winter, basically, like crust forms from the coast out a certain amount of kilometers, depending on what part of Antarctica. And then that crust has a lot of glacial melt that comes from the continent. And that glacial melt is really rich in nutrients. And so that forms a crust on the surface because it's not as heavy as seawater, so it stays on the surface. And in the spring, when it melts, all the krill that had been hiding under the ice have access to this like massive abundance of nutrients from the sea ice melt. And so that's, you know, just one of the examples in which the ecosystem of Antarctica is really attuned to this annual cycle of ice formation and ice melt. So what happens when there's less ice is not only, you know, the ocean has a much a different albedo, so it actually absorbs more heat from the atmosphere mm-hmm. and accelerates the warming. But that there's if there's less ice, then the wind will also mix the layers of the ocean, so that really nutrient dense freshwater layer that usually is on the top is mixed in deeper layers where like algae can't access it. So it kind of messes, it makes these nutrients inaccessible basically to the algae and then subsequently krill. You know, I mentioned the leopard seal issue with like their habitat usually being ice. And then you also have another species, Adelies, who also tend to hang out on ice. So the ice is actually like, you know, we think of it as this like lifeless, just element, but it's really crucial to the ecosystem. And all the species in the Southern Ocean have adapted to the cycle of ice. So when we see a lot less ice, that actually has a really, you know, yeah, as you said, cascading impact on a lot of these species. And we're also seeing, besides from impacts on the ice, the warmth is making weather a lot more volatile. Mm-hmm. And so these species that have been attuned, for example, penguins, to read certain signals in the seasons to think, okay, like this temperature or this, you know, level of sea ice means that it's this time of the year, so it's time to come back to shore to breed. Because those signals are changing, like for example, there might be a week that's really warm and then you'll get a huge dump of snow. And why that matters is like penguins might think it's time to breed, they'll come on shore, they lay their eggs, and then suddenly there's a massive amount of snow. Mm-hmm. That doesn't usually happen that time of year, and they're unable to keep their eggs warm, and then the eggs will die, and they'll be a breeding failure that year. So this increase in unpredictability of the weather kind of messes with these species' ability to like coordinate their breeding season and know like what they need to do when. So that's another pretty major impact in the area.
So as you're studying, I'm imagining in pictures and in data, how far back did the study start that you're looking back and kind of tracking on this? And what? How do you think this is going to inform our future?
Yeah, so there have been people going to Antarctica since, you know, the early 1900s. The program I worked on specifically has, I think, about 30 years of data to go back on. And these long-term data sets are really important because in Antarctica, there is a lot of year-to-year variation. Like every year does look different. So you can't really look at a few years. You really have to look at a really long data set to get the bigger trends mm-hmm. Beyond that year-to-year variation. So into the future, it's really important for the program to be able to access the Antarctica and be able to keep collecting that data consistently in the way it has been collected for us to continue to be able to track these changes. And, you know, that's been a huge challenge, as you can imagine, in COVID times. It was a logistical nightmare to try to get down there with, you know, different quarantine requirements, and especially in the early years, like 2020, 2021. But there has been like an increase in use of like technology, like particularly like wildlife cameras that can also capture like maybe the essential dates of a season if they're trained to look at a colony. So the science is changing a little bit in methods, but the goal is to capture basically the same kind of data year to year into the future. So hopefully, you know, this program will be supported forever, basically, is my goal.
Okay. Well, with all these changes going on, like you say, there's physical changes, chemical, biological changes, climate changes. Are there any species that are actually perhaps benefiting from these things? Perhaps are the leopard seals benefiting this from all these changes?
Yeah, that's a great question. Leopard seals are pretty tricky to study because they're usually pretty they don't really hang out in colonies. So I don't know that we have an accurate view of whether they're benefiting. But I would say that right now we're seeing a slight increase in the population of Gentoo penguins. And that could be a number of factors. One hypothesis is that, because they have a much more flexible diet, they're able to survive a slight decrease in krill, and they also have access to more habitat now that it's getting warmer. They're a little warmer weather species, just a number of factors that make them quote unquote climate winner. But I think the important caveat there is that even though there might be slight increases in population in certain species as climate change starts sort of meddling with an ecosystem, at some point, because it's like no species exists on its own, mm-hmm. like in isolation, basically. So if we do get to a point where the warming causes some kind of ecosystem collapse, which would occur if krill don't reach like a certain threshold in their reproduction, then the whole system collapses anyway. So these increases might seem good at like maybe at this point, but they're still completely tied to the fate of the ecosystem as a whole. And it doesn't mean that they would win in the long term.
Right. I had to put air quotes around the word benefit, because it could be just like you say, a very short term type of thing. Last minute or two. How about you? How did you do in such uninhabitable or, you know, very difficult conditions? How did you do in that?
Yeah. Honestly, I loved it. It was also hard. I'm not going to lie. Like, it's pretty isolated conditions, and we don't really have access to like basic hygiene either. Like, we showered once every 2 weeks. Mm. You know, you wear socks for like 3 or 4 days before you dispatch them. Like, I didn't do laundry the entire, you're just gross. That's just gross.
It's not like a teenage boy locker room, I suspect.
Yeah. But like all our senses are kind of deadened by like the months of grime, so you don't even notice it. But yeah, I think the things I struggled with were like basic hygiene and also like privacy. We're just like all in one cabin for, you know, the entire time. And
You need to bring so perhaps a therapist or a psychologist needs to come along with you guys, if only to evaluate you, you know, do their own separate research on humans and try to address issues that come up. That's its own form of challenge.
Will you be returning, do you think?
Not at this point. I'm actually in grad school in Sweden right now, so I'm not part of the program anymore. But I would love to someday in some capacity. But I think, my life is past the field season point right now. So we'll see. Yeah.
All right.
We are greatly appreciative of you coming on and talking about your findings. You have just written a book. This is Nara DeGracia, who is a biologist. And the book is called The Last Cold Place, A Field Season Studying Penguins in Antarctica. It's befitting for today because we do have actually snow coming down here in Utah,
our own brief,
our own
false,
last cold
false
space right now.
Yeah.
So thank you so much. We appreciate you being here. And where can people go to find out more about your studies and this book?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. My book is available anywhere you buy books, Amazon or bookshop.org if you want to support your local bookshops. I have a website. I'm on Instagram, not super active on Twitter, but I have a handle on there too. So just, Google my name and you'll find me through there.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Yes. Thanks, Nara.
Thank you.
joining us is John Fusatich, who is a professor of wildlife ecology at Michigan Tech and the author of a book called Restoring the Balance, What Wolves Tell Us About Our Relationship with Nature. And I'm really excited to welcome John on the show because a lot of his studies are happening in Michigan, and I am a Michigander. And I've been to many of the beautiful islands, John, like the North and South Manitous, Beaver Island, but I've yet to get to Isle Royal, and it's been a place on my bucket list for a very long time since childhood. First of all, welcome to the show, and can you set the stage before we kind of get into you and your studies about Isle Royal and its environment?
Yeah, you bet. My goodness, it's so great to be here and share this bit of time with you. Isle Royal, it's a national park managed by the National Park Service. It's located in the northwest corner of Lake Superior. That's the biggest freshwater lake in the world and sits in between the United States and Canada. It's a wilderness island. The only way to get there is by boat or to fly and land on a seaplane. And the only humans are not year-round residents there. Humans are only there for a part of the year, mostly for backpacking and some recreation like that. And the star inhabitants of the islands of the island is a population of wolves and moose. And this moose population, its primary cause of death for the moose is to be killed by wolves. And for wolves, the primary source of food is the moose. So the wolves and the moose are in this single predator, single prey setup. And that makes, compared to other parts of nature, it makes us relatively simple. And so ecologists have been interested in that for a long time. The wolves have been there for about 70 years. And the wolf and moose population has been studied continuously since 1959, one of the longest studies, or the longest study of any predator-prey system in the world.
And now that you've kind of set the stage for this place that you've been studying, tell us about your background and what led you to the study of wolves, and particularly your wolf and moose studies, and why that relationship is so important.
Right. Well, you know, as I had mentioned, the study started in 1959, which is quite a few years before I was born. And the project has had three principal investigators over the years. I'm the third, and I started doing work on the island with the wolves and the moose in the mid-1990s. I didn't seek it out. It kind of just happened to me. I went to college and had the great fortune as an undergraduate of working with the person who was leading the study before me, Rolf Petersen, and who is still with the project. And so I've been there for 30 or so years now, and it's been a part of my life pretty intimately all that time.
So 1959, these wolves are introduced to this island. How many and why this island?
In the 1950s, wolves, a couple of things are happening all at the same time. Wolves made it to Isle Royal on their own. And coincidentally, there were people who were very interested in bringing wolves to Isle Royal at that time. And a year or two after there was evidence that wolves were already there, humans went ahead and brought some wolves there anyways. There were four wolves brought. And it's thought that they all died before ever becoming part of the population that was established naturally. That was all happening in the wolves getting there in the 1949, 1950, something like that. Mm-hmm. And then wolves being brought there a couple of years later. And then the intense studies of wolves begins in 1959.
So they literally, I don't know what the distance would be that they had to swim, but they said, hey, there's an island, let's...
There were ice bridges, is that correct?
Yes. No, getting.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, it was a wintertime excursion over to the island. Okay.
Yes, no, exactly. So the waters are, you know, about 25 kilometers or, you know, 15 miles, something like that. And the waters are really quite cold. Even in a warm summer day, the water temperature of Lake Superior is about 40 degrees Fahrenheit. And so an animal as small as a wolf would die from the cold temperatures if they were to swim. Mm-hmm. So the way the wolves got to Isle Royal, and the only way they can get there, is by walking on the ice.
Okay. So there they are. And now, over time, you have this relationship that's been, like you say, has been set up between wolf populations, moose populations. And do those populations vary up and down over time? I mean, I assume that's all part of the research, to observe that relationship of populations and acts between the two.
Yes, no, exactly. So the wolf and moose populations on Isle Royale, indeed, they do fluctuate over time. They go up and they go down. Mm-hmm. That's one of the kind of miraculous things about all of nature. All animal populations fluctuate. And so a big part of studying nature in general is to understand how and why those fluctuations take place. On Isle Royale, we focused on that to put some numbers on it. In a typical year, there might be about, say 20 to 30 wolves on Isle Royale. Mm. It's been as high as 50 and it's been as low as 2. And then for moose, in a typical year, maybe 900 or 1,000 moose. And that also fluctuates quite a lot, from 500 to 2,500. So that, you know, that's a fivefold increase from the minimum to the maximum. So our work has been all about kind of understanding, to being able to describe those fluctuations and to be able to say something about how and why they occur.
And you said that the population had gone all the way down to 2. And I believe that wasn't that long ago that we were looking at this disparity between wolves and moose and maybe the changes that would occur because of that relationship. So now our populations have gone up. Is this driven by human intervention, or was this a natural occurrence? Because I would assume that those ice bridges aren't as prevalent now with climate change.
Yeah, no, exactly. So very, very complicated set of events that occurred, starting in about 2006 all the way up to really to the present day. What's been going on is that over the decades, back to the 1950s, is that wolves would occasionally, like one or two wolves, would occasionally come to Isle Royale by crossing an ice bridge. Mm-hmm. When I say occasionally, maybe like once a decade or something like that. Mm-hmm. As time goes on, the climate has warmed, and then ice bridges become less frequent. And eventually ice bridges became just infrequent enough that wolves were never able to make it from Canada to Isle Royale. The reason this is important is because the island and the wolf population are relatively small, and that means they're vulnerable to inbreeding. And so the occasional immigration would kind of mitigate those inbreeding concerns. Well, when the ice bridges are less frequent and there's not so much immigration, then the inbreeding becomes a problem. And so from about 2006 to 2016, the population really just dropped from kind of typical numbers down to just 2. For a handful of years, there were just 2 wolves. And then in 2019, the National Park Service decided to bring wolves back to Isle Royale to restore wolf predation. And since that happened in 2019, wolf population has been doing very, very well. There's about 30 wolves on the island right now.
Right, because when you get down to 2 wolves, just a handful of wolves, moose population is going to increase, and perhaps increase in somewhat of a negative way, overpopulation.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what we would have expected, and that's exactly what happened. Yeah. And so during this time that the wolf population was getting so low, the moose population was going to some of the highest levels we'd ever seen, really doing pretty serious damage to their food supply, especially a particular tree called balsam fir. And they would have done damage to the forest that would be hard for nature to repair itself off. And so bringing wolves back is kind of an important part of keeping the moose population healthy.
How often do wolves, let's say, harvest, kill a moose? What is their appetite for moose? How many moose are taken in a week or a month's time?
Oh, sure. You know, it varies greatly for 2 reasons. Wolves live in packs. Those are basically family groups. Imagine a set of parents, sometimes called an alpha pair. And then most of the rest of the wolves are offspring, either from that year or current years. So these family groups, they're very wide-ranging in their size. It can be, 4 wolves all the way up to 10 or 12 wolves. Those are common numbers for Isle Royale. In other places, the numbers can be even more wide ranging. You might imagine that a larger pack eats more frequently than a less frequent pack, or than a smaller pack. Accounting for that, Wolves are killing moose on Isle Royale every 4 to 7 days is kind of typical. But the other thing that's really important to know about wolves is that it's hard to do, hard to kill a moose. And so some of whether they're killing more frequently or less frequently has a lot to do with just how many moose are out there. If the moose are in good condition or not good condition, which has a lot to do with, say, winter severity. And that can really greatly increase the frequency or decrease the frequency at which wolves kill moose.
And in other areas, when you're talking about introducing these wolves into an environment, with your book, you call it Restoring the Balance. What does that tell us in other places, and what are the characteristics of wolves that have an impact on an environment, and what are the changes that you see in general?
Right. So, if nature's full of variation, and so the shortest, most honest answer about how wolves affect their prey populations and the ecosystems they live in is that it's a varied effect, and it changes over time. Sometimes their effect is really a big deal, and other times it's a bit less of a big deal. While there's all that variation, it is also at the same time the case that the general effect of wolves or any large predator is to keep the prey abundance a bit less. And if we're thinking about different parts of the world, this prey is white-tailed deer or elk or bison or moose, again, depending on where we're at. And when those populations of prey, those large herbivores, when that's less, as a result of predation, then it allows vegetative communities to flourish more. So anyways, that's kind of in a thumbnail sketch, the effect of predators.
We're speaking with John Vucetich. He's the professor of wildlife ecology at Michigan Tech and the author of the book Restoring the Balance, What Wolves Tell Us About Our Relationships with Nature. And to kind of follow along that, I know there was a study done, at this point it's probably several years ago, either let's say in Montana or so, that showed not only when wolves were reintroduced to an ecosystem, not only did they start to control populations of elk and deer and such, but there were other biological benefits, most notably the trees benefited. Like you alluded to it with the Douglas fir, one of those firs. Not only trees along the stream banks were able to grow older, and their root systems helped to benefit and support the stream bank, which in the end supported the trout populations, benefited the trout population because the water ran clear and had a higher quality that benefited trout. So the trickle-down effect, John, is obvious when you have an alpha predator species like the wolf in an ecosystem.
Right, and some of the mechanisms behind that are relatively easy to understand, all of those kind of knock-on effects.
Yeah.
If you're reducing ungulates, the herbivores, and then if you're allowing the vegetation to either flourish or be of a certain kind that grows when there's not so much herbivory, well, that vegetation, we're talking about the nature of the forest or the nature of the trees right along the creek or the nature of the grassland, when you're changing that, that's the habitat for all kinds of species. And so that's how it is that all these other species, whether it be songbirds or fish or beavers, that's how all these other things end up changing, because you're changing the basic structure of the habitat when these things go. That being said, I should say, for as important as the effects of carnivores are, I don't know that the effects on their ecosystem is the most important reason for restoring them. I think the most important reason for restoring them is that humans were wrong to have extirpated them in the first place. And basically we extirpated them out of hatred. And now we're at a point in our human history where we have better views of carnivores and we have the ability to right some of those past wrongs. Truthfully, I think that's the more important reason to be restoring carnivores.
And so when you're conducting these studies, what is that process like?
You know, the centerpiece of our work is a winter field season. And the winter field season involves flying from a small aircraft. We're talking a plane that has room for a pilot and one passenger. And you're flying over a frozen landscape. So imagine all white, and the leaves have fallen off of the trees, so you can see the ground pretty well. And what's especially important is you can see the tracks of animals from the small aircraft. This is what allows us to see so many things from an airplane. This is how we count the wolves. This is how we count the moose. This is how we're able to see how frequently it is that the wolves kill the moose. And so a great deal comes from that. We also have summer field season that lasts for a couple of months. A lot of that work has to do with hiking in the backcountry. We rely on citizen scientist volunteers to help us with that and in all of this hiking. One of the things we're looking for is places where moose have died. And when we find a place where moose have died, we perform a necropsy. And we learn a ton about the living population by knowing what the condition of these moose are, basically right at the time that they died. How old were they? Were they in really good shape or not such good shape at the time of their death? What was the cause of death? All these kinds of things. That comes from just putting on a lot of miles in the backcountry looking for these carcasses.
All right, let's talk about the word used, hatred and fear, unwarranted and otherwise, with respect to wolves. Where does it find its... is there an origin story associated with that? Who's to blame? I want to name names. Besides besides John, Liam Neeson and his movie The Gray. That would be
right,
fun.
Right. Exactly. We won't talk too much about that movie.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure you prefer not to mention that one, but go ahead.
Yeah, no, for sure. You know, one of the things that humans do, we just can't control ourselves in this way, is we turn animals into symbols. Mm. We just do it. It appears to be part of our nature. And I don't know that there's anything fundamentally wrong with that, but sometimes animals suffer because of that. And so wolves are two things for humans. They are symbols of all of the things that we love about nature, and they are also symbols of all of the things that we are afraid of about nature. I don't think anyone knows exactly why this is the case. Why it is that wolves have this kind of outsized role as terms of symbols. But a couple of ideas that come to mind is that, I think when we look at a wolf, I think we're not sure whether to admire them because of how similar they are to us. They live in family groups, really distinctive among large mammals and large carnivores, but that's exactly how humans live. And for those of us humans who like to eat meat, well, so do wolves. And so I think we look at wolves and we're not sure whether to admire them or be jealous of them or see them as competitors. And from all of that comes all of these thoughts of love and fear, depending on the person holding those feelings.
Well, I'll tell you this. I'm from New Jersey, and back in the 60s, my first introduction with wolves was via Hollywood and Disney, right? The classic cartoon wolf, conniving, to be feared, unpredictable. And I think a lot of that fear also comes from the fact that they travel in packs. It's not a singular animal like a mountain lion or cougar that also has some level of fear associated and respectfully so. But I think there's something about animals that travel in packs that create an extra level of anxiety.
Yeah, I suppose so. And perhaps the extra anxiety, and as I mentioned again, just the extra connection between humans and nature. And you were making some nice comparisons with mountain lions. And of course, this is where things are a little bit odd, because like a mountain lion actually is a genuinely dangerous animal when it comes to human safety, and occasionally humans are killed by mountain lions. Humans are occasionally killed by grizzly bears, but to be killed by a wolf is stunningly rare. And so there's really this kind of misproportion fear that we assign to them. Again, some of this is just part of human nature, but we are also smart enough to kind of control our fears and put them in check when that's the right thing to do.
So when people are reading your book, what are some of the biggest takeaways that you would like people to go away with?
I think there's two messages in the book. One is about the role and effect of climate change on our protected areas like national parks. And we have to decide whether to, when climate change takes something away from a national park or protected area, are we gonna fight against that and try to save whatever it is that climate change is threatening? Or do we just say, hey, that's the new world that we live in, and some of these things might not be part of that new world. The National Park Service is wrestling with this question, and the decision to bring wolves back to Isle Royale after the loss of those ice bridges was what that was all about. It's not a resolved issue in the big picture. So that's part of what the book is about. The other part of the book is really about the time that I spent on Isle Royale and what it is that I learned about the wolves and the moose themselves. Most important lesson there is that, you know, wolves and moose, they have lives. They have their own lives. They have their own interests. They have their own aspirations for what happens later in the day and tomorrow and the next day. And they can be respected and cared for just on those terms, because those are things that we connect with as well, because we have interests and lives our own selves. And so there's a strong, strong connection between their lives and ours. That's the other, probably more important message of the book.
Well, do you see programs going around the country that are, you know, endeavoring to reintroduce wolves as beneficial? And where are there states or regions where wolves shouldn't be reintroduced? Or maybe it would be too complicated to reintroduce them. I'm thinking of Utah.
Sure, sure. You know, the state of Colorado has recently embarked on a project to bring wolves back to that state. That's probably the newest and most notable sort of effort to bring wolves back. There are ongoing efforts. Things have been going on for a while and still going on to bring Mexican wolves back, mm-hmm. To the desert Southwest, and then to do better by red wolves, right. Which is taking place in the East. And so anyways, those are some of the places where wolves are trying to do better. Wolves used to live basically every part of the lower 48. Mm. And there's no one that I know of who's arguing that wolves need to be brought back to all of these places.
Right.
But at the same time, wolves currently only live in about 15% of the places that they used to in the lower 48. So I know we can do much better than we currently are. How much better? I'm not sure, but definitely a lot better. And so the reason that this question is so important about wolves is because it speaks to so many other animals as well. The biodiversity crisis has two elements of it. One is global extinction of species, but the other, possibly more insidious element of the biodiversity crisis is that so many species, most species in fact, have been lost from most of their geographic ranges, mm-hmm. but they're still not like at risk of going extinct from the planet. So it's the species that have been lost from so many places, that's where the real action is, I think, on the biodiversity crisis in terms of mitigating that, making that better. And that forces the question, okay, how many of the former places that animals used to live, should they live now? It's really a question about how much sharing do humans want to do? Because it'll take, you know, it'll be inconvenient in some cases. It'll cause us to restrict some of our activities in some cases. And so it's really about sharing the planet with other kinds of creatures.
And we are going to be getting into some of these protections in just a moment,
right,
with our second guest. But we are so glad that you came on the show, John, and that you taught us a little bit more about the behaviors of wolves and why they're important, right, and why we should be respecting and protecting. And where would people go if they wanted to learn more about Isle Royale and the wolf studies there and also your writings?
Right. The easiest place for finding out about Isle Royale is isleroyalwolf.org. Easy to type into any internet search engine. And then Restoring the Balance, any place that you buy books is where you can get a copy of the book.
Fantastic. That is John Vucetic, and he is a professor of wildlife ecology at Michigan Tech and also the author of Restoring the Balance, What Wolves Tell Us About Our Relationship with Nature. Thank you, John, for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks, John.
Oh, it's so great to be here. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to This Green Earth. If you like the show and you learned something new, make sure you leave a review, and we'd appreciate it if you click 5 stars.
You can email us your thoughts, comments, and ideas for topics and stories you'd like us to cover to This Green Earth, all one word, at kpcw.org.